a thrill too for me to be back here at Columbia for a fourth. This is the fourth Sweet Fest. It's such a pleasure to be working with Wade again and Carol Ann, and we sort of formed a meal. We formed the organizing committee for this, and we've gotten to the point where we know each other well enough that we would have periodic conference calls. And in our early planning days, maybe even our first call, we were brainstorming, who can we get that would be just really a fantastic keynote? And I think it might have been Wade that says, Kim, do you think we might be able to have Seymour? And I said, oh, Seymour. I said, I can tell you this. The man is, you know, you can imagine the demand, right? And the requests for Seymour to speak. And I said, but I happen to have, you know, maybe a little bit of an inside line. And I said, I agree, that would be absolutely fantastic. I know that, you know, everybody coming to the Sweet Fest would love it. Let me see what I can do. So the good news was it was early. The other really good news is I know Seymour has a special place in my heart, and I kind of feel it might be a mutual thing. I've had the pleasure of knowing him for 20 years since starting my work with Alan Kay. And I have been as inspired as I'm sure all of you have by Seymour's words, both written and just verbal personal conversation. And we are so thrilled. We're really so, so lucky to have him come to this really small gathering to speak to us all. So I know he continues to inspire, and I will introduce you all to Neil Gibson. Thank you.
Kim, you always will have a little place in my heart. No, sir. Thank you. It has been very inspiring. Anyway, what I want to talk about is way back then, a little bit, and where we go forward. I just like to contrast the mood of talking about computers and education when I first met Alan Kay, which was almost 40 years ago. And it's almost 20 years before Kim knew. I think it was 1968. Or possibly, it was 1968. In those days, 68 and into the 70s, computers were pretty inaccessible things for kids. I remember getting a reviewer comment on one of the first proposals we submitted for developing computer-based work for kids, which the reviewer said, in indignation, he said, this is scandalous to spend public money on work that could be of benefit only to the children of millionaires. We said with a straight face, and it might have seemed like that. That is, it was obvious. It's obvious to Adam, it's obvious to me, obvious to people who really looked closely at it, that the day would come when computers would be not only for millionaires, but for everyone. And we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know how long it might take, but it was obvious that it would come. And I think most of us estimating then were not too far off in the time course. But it wasn't the time that was important, it was that we knew it would come, and what was on our minds was that learning, what we call education, could be radically, deeply different in the context where you have computers as the primary medium for work rather than pencil, paper, print, video, and those things. So we were engaged in pretty fundamental questions. How could it really change? With time, change really began to happen, but I think certainly not the way I anticipated. What I didn't anticipate was the what's brought out in Al Gore's movie, if you haven't seen it, you really should. I think it's a model not only about the environment, you probably won't, I didn't think I learned anything about global warming, I didn't already know, but it's got me thinking an awful lot about how one might go about advocating or fighting for a big, big change in the way people think. And I think what we're engaged in education is of the same kind of magnitude, and maybe it's a prerequisite to that. Maybe people have to learn to think different and learn different before they can do what Gore is trying to bring about in thinking about the environment. But it's a model. I don't think we thought very much about that, about how to persuade the world. It just seemed to us obvious that if you could do things better, that would be adopted. What we didn't think about is a metaphor that I've used often and that Gore uses very dramatically in that movie, and the metaphor is a famous saying that if you put a frog in cold water and gradually heat it up, the frog will die unless he's rescued. But if you throw the frog into almost boiling water, he will jump out and save himself. And I think one thing that happened with computers and the school world is that the frog in the slowly heating up water. So as computers gradually came into the school world, the school world gradually adapted itself and assimilated them and had time to take them up and make them part of the way it always did things. There are a lot of good analogies one can use. Another one that I've often used is that what we've seen happen in the school world is a kind of analogous to the biological defense mechanisms against foreign bodies coming into your immune system, is armed to set up defense mechanisms that isolate any foreign intruder. And I think school has done this with the computer, that is, it's had time to sort of revolutionize this thing, normalize it, so that all the talk in the education world is how to integrate this computer into school, how to integrate it into the curriculum. And behind that is the idea that school, as it is practiced, is a given. The curriculum, as it is established, is a given. And it's the computer that has to be modified and brought into line with it. And that's what they do. And this is a radical difference from the point of view, the way that we were thinking as late as, well, before the great exciting revolution of the microcomputer that really, in one way, showed we were right all along. In another way, undid us for the moment. So, now the question is, are we at a point where we can go back to those days? Are we at a point where we can really reopen the question? Is the role of the computer to improve the system as it exists or to overturn it? Does the computer serve the curriculum or does it make it obsolete? I think it's clearly it makes it obsolete. And frankly, I mean, I didn't anticipate it would be such a long time, but the length of the time has led me to do a lot of thinking, and constructive and useful thinking. I'd refer you to some first purpose tentative probings in a paper that you'll find on the website papert.org called Why School Reform is Impossible. And I do think school reform is impossible. If school reform means what it usually does, that somebody has worked out an alternative. And this is going to be imposed on the big system, the small system, this school can't happen. The system is too complex for that. Nobody can invent that. Change can happen, but it has to happen in an evolutionary way. It has to evolve. It can't be made and imposed. I think this is something that needs to be theorized, and already in that paper and much since then, I've complained about the habit of this culture of people writing about, thinking about educational innovation, especially the so-called, all those, like I suppose everybody in this room is, you believe in some version of what's called constructivism or constructionism and child-centered and developmental education. So what is developmental education? Basically it says, you can't teach children by telling them, this is what you ought to know. You do something more dynamic. You create the conditions where their thinking is going to develop. But interestingly, if you look at the papers that the developmental educators write for their fellow educators, they tell them what to do. And so they contradict themselves in their approach to educational change. And this is the dilemma we need to get out of. We need to develop a new way of thinking about how to produce change. And obviously it can only happen in small steps, but the small steps have to be, I think, two properties. First of all, it must be mindful. Maybe they're both mindful. That is, we must make our small steps with a big goal in mind. And it's very tempting. I've fallen into this over and over again. It's very tempting when you think, gosh, there's a school. Well, there's a chance of getting those kids the opportunity to spend 2 or 3 hours a week doing something really exciting. I'm going to do that. I can't give up that. So I start talking to the school about how it's good for you to do this. And I start trying to present it in a way that would be acceptable to that school, but slippery slope, because in a while you're presenting in a way that's acceptable to this very system you're trying to overthrow, and you're neutralizing yourself, you're becoming part of this neutralizing process. I've often been quoted on this following incident, where Alan Kay and I were both the keynote speakers at the World Conference on Computers and Education in Sydney, I think in 92 or something, somewhere in the early 90s. Alan did the opening keynote and I did the closing keynote, and my theme was this: I hope this is the last conference, the last World Conference on Computers and Education. Because the very idea of having a conference on computers and education expresses a kind of slave mentality. We are putting ourselves in the service of somebody else. After all, those other people don't have conferences on paper in education. They just take it for granted. And until we take it for granted that computers are there as the natural medium of expression, we are only serving their purposes. They didn't even invite me again. And they went on having conferences. I think it's a question, is the tipping point, are we getting tripped, is it possible? And I'd like to throw that out at you and get feedback, maybe now in discussion, maybe in emails, or maybe indirectly. I might even hear about it, but in the thoughts you might have, in the discussions you might have among each other, and with your friends and colleagues and students especially, when you go home. But what really are the conditions for change? And I think that I would take a bet that most of you are doing very wonderful things with Squeak, with children, with ideas, probably spend much more time on thinking about what to do on this particular project that you're working on, or your particular school, or wherever you are, than on the question of how can this translate into really changing it? And what would it mean to really change it? And I would like to incite you to shift the, however much time you spend, however you distribute your time between these two, to shift more towards spending more time on that big question. Because in a sense, it's that big question that gives meaning, real meaning to what you're doing in the more immediate thing. It's easy to think it's impossible. So it's worth, I'm going to throw a few just fairly random thoughts about why it's not so impossible. About not long before that time in 68 when I met Alan, there was a movement in the United States, not in the United States, almost all over the world, there was the biggest systematic attempt to change the mathematics and science curriculum that's ever been made. It was called the New Math. And it really was radical. And it really was widespread. And it really goes against any kind of easy idea that you can't change this. Rather, we might ask ourselves, how come that it happened then? And what lessons are to be learned from it? Now, how come it happened then has an easy answer. Panic. It's a crisis. The Soviets had put out a Sputnik and shocked Americans particularly that somebody else, especially those people, could be ahead in any area of tech. And this came shortly after they're doing an atomic bomb test 5 years earlier than all the experts had predicted. There was panic. And under those conditions, a sense of crisis, they could do it. So the question is, what sense of crisis? Is there another sense of crisis here or coming? Hold on to that for a moment. I think there is, but this might not be the obvious one. What went wrong with that? Well, partly when they realized there wasn't really a threat of that sort, that the threat from the Soviets was not about Sputnik, this all calmed down and they stopped and simply went back to where they were before. But more interesting is the conclusion that many people seem to have drawn from that we tried to change it and it didn't work, so let's not change it. Terrible logic. In fact, the real lesson is it went off so much in exactly the wrong direction that the best formula I know for how to change mathematics is to look and see what they did and do the exact opposite. Now, it wasn't because they were stupid or wanted to do bad by kids. It's because they didn't have the technology. And what they did was, as I said, go exactly in the wrong direction. And I'd like to pinpoint just what that, why I think that was exactly the wrong direction. So putting that in a little bit of context, I'd like to think back on where did mathematics and science, let's concentrate on mathematics just for simplicity, but don't pick on me and say, what about all the other areas? Because exactly the same things apply there. Mathematics was being born not as mathematics, but as a mathematical way of thinking about other things. You know, way back there were, in Egypt, people building these huge pyramids and worrying about when would the waters of the Nile rise? And there were other people worrying about how to navigate across the waters when you couldn't see the land. And there were other people worrying about how to predict the future. Doesn't matter if the future predicting was based on principles of astrology that not everybody accepts today, but they were trying to predict. These are the kind of things they would do. And bit by bit, a new way of thinking about those things crept in that you could call mathematical thinking. And bit by bit, this mathematical thinking got richer and richer, and bit by bit, it turned into this wonderful thing called pure mathematics. You know, one of the greatest products of the human mind, but remember, it was a product not of a human mind, it was a product of a long evolution. And let's look at how that evolution came. Before I began to think about computers and learning, I'd spent several years with Jean Piaget in Geneva, and we thought a lot about all sorts of questions, but I think Piaget was wrong about a lot of things, a lot of details, but I think he was very right about a lot of fundamentals. And one of the things he was right about is that if you want to understand the evolution of thinking in a in an individual, evolution of intelligence, he would say, in a child, think about how that evolution in the history of ideas took place. And don't be too literal-minded, don't look for too detailed parallels, but in its general shape, there's a lot to be learned by that, from that comparison. And I think one thing to be learned is that at least we should ask the question, wouldn't it maybe be better if we could have children go through the same sort of evolutionary process as I was describing in the development of mathematics? Wouldn't it be better if they started with a mathematical way of thinking in doing other stuff? Well, what other stuff? We can't give them pyramids to build. Schools are too overcrowded already. We can't send them navigating across the oceans. It's a bit dangerous, etc., etc. Some people talking about, well, giving the children learning by doing, making things, there are lots of doing, I mean, all sorts of Montessori, all sorts of people. But using an analogy that I've used for a long time, I like to think of it as a bit like Leonardo da Vinci, and this sort of pops up now because of all the fuss about from Dan Brown and so on, but the analogy I like to make is that Leonardo invented a lot of things. He was an amazing inventor. He tried to invent an airplane. And if you look at his drawings and you look at it in terms of what you know about him, you can see, A, it wouldn't fly from his drawings. B, I'm quite sure if he'd been able to make one following those drawings, from the way it didn't fly, he would have learned how to make one that would be better. But he couldn't make one even from his drawings because he didn't have the technology, the technological infrastructure that you need in order to do that. By the time of the Wright brothers, the situation was very different. They had machine tools, they knew about all sorts of materials, engines, all sorts of stuff that didn't have much to do with airplanes as such, and was too much for any one person, even Leonardo, to invent. There just wasn't the technology, and I think this is what is true about people who were exploring ideas of learning in a more active way. There wasn't the technology that would enable them to take their ideas, which are basically right, but they couldn't debug them, they couldn't really turn them into viable form because they didn't know how to implement them. And it's through implementing the idea that it grows from a little spark to a real flame. So we've got that. At the time of the new math, going back to that, we started this sort of digression about evolution of mathematics, that in terms of this historical development, I'd say what's wrong with the way we teach math is that we reverse that historical order that starts from mathematics in the real world and develops from that to pure mathematics as a formal system. The new math people just couldn't do that. And so they didn't have that as an alternative combined with various other things in the air at the time. They went in the opposite direction. They took this formal thing and they tried to make it even more formal. And that's the primary sense in which they went in the wrong direction. Mathematics, as we teach it in school, is already much too formal. And they made it more formal. There are other ways in which they went wrong, which it's worth being aware of now, related in relation to the presence of computers, and that's that they completely ignored the sort of social resonance of the idea that most parents faced with this new math couldn't make sense of it. And that had a lot to do with it turning into a joke and people not liking it, and for it not working, in fact, because it's not likely that if the parents are suspicious of something and distrusted, that the kids will really thrive on it. Or it's going to have a very strong hold on the kids before that happened, which might be the case with some new things. But with the new things, they do have a strong hold on the kids, but also the idea that computation and computers are an important direction of doing stuff, this has become part of the common culture, and so that is much more acceptable. So in lots of ways, in going towards the more using it rather than formalizing it, in going towards connecting with what's in the culture of today rather than going against it, and in many other respects, I don't want to go too much to the new math, but it's worth thinking about that. Change did happen, it was possible, and it could go in an opposite direction, or in a different direction. And that's not just abstract. You look concretely, you can see very precisely ways in which that experiment of the new math just was wrong. So what do we do? I'll tell you about a mischievous experiment I did with kids. I provoked a few dozen kids to ask their teachers, for example, choose a good moment, like when we're doing fractions. Why do we need to do that? Now, it was a mischievous experiment, and I did apologize to the teachers involved afterwards. But because it was mischievous, because I knew the teachers would not be able to answer the question in a good way. Almost one or two actually did much better than I thought possible. But although I have a huge respect for teachers, this is not an anti-teacher remark. It's that teachers are trapped in a situation where they have to defend something that's indefensible. And even to the extent that it could be somewhat defended, they're not given the ammunition and the background to be able to defend it. So the typical answer that was reported back to me by these kids was, when you need math, because when you go out into the real world, in the supermarket, you buy things and your mom, et cetera, and the bad thing about that is, well, first of all, that every kid knows it's not true. And every kid knows in the supermarket, nobody does those things. Machines do them, maybe. So the net effect is the kids see this as just being lied to, that this is another piece of teacher double talk. And this is really bad because it's undermining the respect that the teacher ought to be getting. And it's lying to kids. Nothing could be worse for learning than lying. And what really is painful is that I know those teachers, some of them, and they're the last people in the world who would want to lie to a kid. They love kids, and they want to do, but they are placed in a situation where they don't have any choice. The situation forces them to lie about. Well, now, why do we teach these children fractions? Or if we look through the content of the math curriculum, I mean, this applies to other things, as I said, I'm concentrating on math, because it's the extreme case. you look through it and you might say, well, what point is there? Why do we teach this? Well, part of it is what I call Latinesque justification. You know, when I was a kid, I'm old enough so that when I went to school, any kid who didn't study Latin and preferably Greek was a kid left behind. And why? Man, nobody thought we actually use it, but it was maintained for good or bad reasons that learning Latin was good for your development in other respects. I don't want to go into why it was or why it wasn't. We will laugh at that. But in a way, I think the laugh and boots on the other foot, we're laughing too soon, because in fact, most of what we teach kids is just like that justification. It's not that. But so by Latinesque, I mean justifying a piece of knowledge, not because you're actually going to use that knowledge. And I don't just mean use in a, you know, in a crassly pragmatic, materialistic way. If you use it for this in a spiritual way, or to think great thoughts, or to think you make beauty, that's just as much use. But that wasn't the justification of the Latin. I mean, the Latinesque justification is that you're using it not for its own learning, not for its own sake, but because it serves some other purpose, usually not very well spelled out. And in the case of the mathematics, it's almost all like that. And why should you know that if not applying this fraction by dividing this fraction by that fraction, you turn it upside down, or you find common denominators, or even solve those little word problems, or what's the point? Whoever uses a formula for solving quadratic equations, nobody ever uses any of these things. If they have a purpose, it's because in some way they are supposed to prepare the way or prepare your mind. Well, now, is this the case? Is there any evidence that teaching children these things at a young age prepares their minds? I don't know any good study or even how you do a really rigorous study, but I'll throw a few observations. I was very close friend of Hao Wang. Hao Wang was one of the great logicians of our century. Unfortunately, died. He could do the most incredible mathematical manipulations. He could do them in his head or even on paper. It's amazing. There are some people whose ability to take mathematical things and manipulate them is just is breathless, and he's one of those. He grew up in China and in a social setting where he had a traditional Chinese education, where they didn't do any mathematics before the age 11. They studied philosophy and poetry and calligraphy and writing and some history. No mathematics. After 11, they studied mathematics. He's not the only one. I've interviewed a few other people from that culture. Same story. Another kind of evidence. Some years ago in Mexico, the company Telmex, that's the biggest, when they privatized the telephone system, Telmex took over the system, and part of the agreement was they would not fire any of the workers. But they didn't want to transform what was a totally old-fashioned analog system into a modern digital system. There's a serious problem about those workers, because what for them, telephone maintenance was, you find these wires, and it's not working, you know, for a break, or maybe at most you solder, but nothing more sophisticated than that. And now they want to be the same people to work with the most sophisticated digital. So they set up a program, essentially, of school. And I've looked at the data. They taught them the stuff that you normally learn in school, that these people, if they'd ever been exposed to it, as educators say, it didn't sink in. Most of them, they didn't know anything. As a rough estimate, they learned school math about somewhere between 7 and 10 times as fast as is done in school. And I would attribute that to a couple of reasons. I think the Paulo Freirean principle, that because it was, you know, it's part of work life, real life, they could learn it better and faster. They were more mature, they knew a lot of other things, all sorts of reasons. But they could learn it 10 times as fast, which raises this question. Even if we want to give, even if we think kids ought to have all that stuff we teach them, maybe we're just being incredibly inefficient by spending all that time and effort and money and doing so much psychological damage to those kids who, for one reason or another, don't, you quote, do well at it, and so are classified as, quote, dumb, or I don't have a head for figures, or some other self-derogatory kind of judgment. Maybe if you just did this 10 years later or 5 years later, you could do it enormously more efficiently. These questions are not discussed in the education community. The education research community is entirely focused on how the system that is there works, or how it doesn't work, or how to fix it by making local fixes. Nobody is really asking the question, what would it be like to have a real alternative? And why not? And how does this one that we have match up? Well, you couldn't match it up unless you designed an alternative. You've got some other alternative that you want to put in its place. So that's the real question for us, and the real question I want to sort of say a few more things about and sit down and get reactions. But I think this is really the thing that people like us here in this group have to be putting serious amounts of our time into thinking about. It's too easy, and may I say, self-indulgent for us, and we all love to do it, and I'm not, I'm the first to receive any sort of criticism that comes from that. It is self-indulgent to say, I can spend 3 hours with a kid every week and do something wonderful. Well, you can, but what about the billion other kids? And what about the rest of the time for that kid? And it is not, it's irresponsible of us, because we have, that is, the people who have felt the power of what you can do when powerful ideas are embodied in computational tools. We who have felt that power have that responsibility to translate that into a form that can be, have a chance to put up the fight. Well, how do we do it? I used to use the slogan a lot, and for a while didn't, but I think I'm bringing it back. Instead of trying to make kids love the math they hate, let's make a math they will love. And how do we go about making a math they will love? So I've just gone through a few, I think there are a few big principles. I mean, I think one is what's in my story about the pyramid. We must start seeing and be prepared to recognize math as a mathematical way of thinking that happens in the course of doing other things. Which you do automatically. I mean, every time you get a kid to write a program to make a little car move around, you are doing that, you're introducing a mathematical way of thinking into your construction or playing a little game. So you're taking the first step, but there are two more steps. One is to be conscious, and for the kid to be conscious, and for the people around you to be conscious, that this is something very different, and is just a first step. And secondly, I think that means including trying to make more explicit what are those ideas and how do they relate So this is being mindful about it, putting it on another level. I'll give you a little example of something that only occurred to me very, very recently, and it's something I find hard to understand. I never thought like this. So when we introduce the I, so let me talk a little bit about this turtle. What's this thing about him, having this object? Well, you can look at it two ways, and I think that I think quite literally tens of thousands of teachers who have given literally tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions, large numbers of students through various programming forms, some sort of experience. Most of those think of it as, well, this is a nice way to do a little bit of programming. It's a nice way to maybe do a little corner of mathematics. You can do polygons and a few things like that. I don't think many teachers really understand, because it's not their fault. It's because their mathematical education didn't give them the foundation for understanding, and I think this is something that, you know, that we people like me who come from mathematics into this and do have the understanding have not done as good a job as we might have in putting out to people. The reason why that turtle is so interesting is because what it really does is to bring into the compass of what children can do one of the half dozen most important ideas ever in the history of mathematics, and that's Newton's idea of differential calculus. Now, some little investigation of it teaches, this isn't a statement about teachers, it's a statement about the education of teachers. None of the logo teachers I spoke to in the meeting made that connection that this had anything to do with calculus. But it has to do with what calculus really is about, which is not about the derivative of x to the n is n times x to the n minus 1. It's about the idea, brilliant idea of Newton, that if you want to understand the orbit of the moon around the earth or the earth around the sun, what you really need to know is that from the way in which the gravitation of the sun affects the earth just right now, from its local behavior just there, from that you've got to be able to and can deduce the behavior of the whole path. The shape of the path, that ellipse, is, let's say, a global phenomenon. Understanding it locally is the big step. That's what differential equations are about. It's about going from the little step to the big, globally to globally. Now, Newton, having done this, it got translated into a lot of algebraic manipulations about how to put this into practice. It's inaccessible to young children. All of a sudden, though, with the computer, it becomes accessible. And so this idea of the turtle circle, that different from Euclid says, okay, a circle is point at a fixed distance from a given. But if you imagine an ant walking on a circle or on a path and trying to decide, is this a circle? That ant could not decide whether it's a circle according to Euclid's definition, because you have to look outside the circle at this distant point. And if you only look at the little pieces one at a time, that's your total field of view. You can't know it's a circle. But the turtle can, because the turtle knows as it goes around that each piece is made with the same amount of turning for the same amount of going forward. So there's a big, big, amazing idea that you can know that you're on a circle just bit by bit without having to go out and look at the whole. So how do we convey that idea that this is amazing? Well, first one's going to appreciate it as amazing. And to appreciate it as amazing, maybe it certainly helps to know its historical connection, what it did in the history of science, but also to put it in the context of a lot of other things. One of the things that I find most amazing about that sort of thing is thinking about control mechanisms. Is suppose you had this actual physical turtle walking about on the floor, and it's got light sensors and so on, and you wanted to, the one that I use most often, actually, Alan always teases me because I jumped on a table at a meeting. I can't remember. Anyway, if I've got this turtle that I wanted to walk around the table, I want to program it to do that. There's a pre-Newtonian way of doing it. Globally, I measure the table. This is, say, 100 units, and that's a square table. So I say, go forward 100 units, and then turn right 90 degrees, and go forward 100 units again, and walk around the table. No, it probably won't. Probably won't, because you didn't measure exactly. The turtle doesn't behave exactly. And besides, even to walk around the table, it wouldn't walk around that table. A much better way is, forget about the global property of the table, and you just do this little program that, where if you're touching the table, turn away from it, so you might bump into it, take a step forward, and if you're not touching the table, you might be getting away from it, so turn towards it, take a little step forward, and keep on doing that, and it will get you around the table. When you get to the end, you'll do this little turtle circle thing of forward, a little right, a little until you get back into it. And so it's amazing that the thing can go around the table without knowing anything about the shape of the table. And it will work just on a round table or a triangular table. Or suppose you want to program it to go over towards a light over there that's got a light sensor. Even more amazing in a way that you might think, well, I'm going to program this little robot to go to that light, so what do? Find some way to find out the direction and distance to that light. This is pre-Newton. This is the way Kepler had to think. Kepler knew this was he could think of it globally. So then I know where it is, I can direct myself. Except it probably wouldn't work either because I'd probably be a little bit out of this. Much better. If I just have side light sensors and I can just tell whether it's more to the left or more to the right, and I go a little step forward, and if it's more to the right, I turn a little bit right, and it's more to the left. So a little local, step by step, a little local. And what's even more amazing is it brings out the fact that through very inaccurate, you didn't have to turn exactly, I mean, you have a crummy mechanism. So when you try to make it turn 1 degree, it turns 3 degrees or a quarter of a degree, doesn't matter. From crummy, partial, local knowledge, you can get precise global effects, you can get there. Isn't that amazing? And so we find more and more ways out. Unless we can see this as amazing, we're missing the whole thing. We're missing, we've got to see it as amazing. To see it as amazing, we have to put it in a bigger context. I've used another principle that covers this, and that's principle of re-empowerment of. See, the idea, Newton's idea was a powerful idea to change science. But like many other examples of what happens when it gets into the school curriculum, it's disempowered. It's turned into something which kids have to learn to pass the test, or because the teacher told them, well, they didn't believe what the teacher said anyway, but they did know that if they didn't pass the test, they'd be in trouble, or their parents would beat on them, or they wouldn't get to college. But they don't appreciate this as something powerful in itself. So systematically, the most powerful ideas have been disempowered. A good strategy, identify those powerful ideas, and then the strategy to re-empower the idea that has been disempowered. One other point about these turtle things that, you know, that's missed, and I find this one's missed not so much because teachers don't have the mathematical background, but because they're sort of shy. But they'd be less shy if the sort of reason was more emphasized. Although this one I did in Mindstorms, I think I did emphasize it, and that is the fact that you can identify with this thing is just terribly important. The idea that I work with kids, and I like to talk about making a circle when the kid wants to do something like that, or how, what angle to use for, to do it, walk it out, describe yourself doing it. But I think a lot of, especially math teachers, are a bit shy about walking in a circle themselves. Seems a bit too touchy-feely. But it's important because of two reasons. One, it's putting you inside the mathematics, so it's making it much closer to you. It's not this deep, dispassionate, disembodied, bloodless thing. It's you are in it. And also, you're drawing on knowledge that you have. You know, I think this thing about, well, you can tell that that's 120 degrees, because everybody knows, but nowadays anyway, because of another technology like skateboards, every kid knows what a 360 is. So that's all the way around is 360. Well, it's something that one should make a lot of and not just try and slip it in. You make a lot of it. It's a big thing. That's a theorem. It's a fixed, and it's a theorem that you knew. And you knew it in the form of your own body knowledge, and now what we're doing with this is bringing out your body knowledge into a more generalizable and usable form. So all of these are ways of thinking that ought to be made explicit in dealing with kids and ought to be generalized to using to developing a different way of thinking about the mathematics. Let me take another little example since I mentioned the angles. I hear a lot of debate, discussion about how do we deal with the fact that the logo angle, or squeak horn, when you're doing these things, we usually talk about how much you turn. So if you're drawing a triangle, you make the thing go forward so much it turns 120, right? But in the school textbooks, they don't talk about that angle. They talk about you know, this. That angle, so that angle, that turn is 120, and they talk about the 60. And their form of the theorem is that the sum of the internal angles is 60 degrees, and our form of the theorem is the sum of these, what they would call external angles, is 360 degrees. And so here's an example of intellectual cowardice and of sort of being subservient to the system. That generally speaking, people doing this sort of stuff, when they do a little bit of logo or squiggle or turtle stuff in relation to mathematics, they sort of apologize for the fact that you're using a different sort of angle. But really, they shouldn't be apologizing, they should be boasting. Because if we look and say, what is the difference between these two angles? In the math books, it's called internal and external angles. But there's another way of thinking about it, that if you think of statically of angle as related to drawing, this is a natural way to think about it. But if you think of angle in the real world turning, it's not the natural way, it's the turtle way is the natural way. The air traffic controller, I'm an airplane pilot, and the traffic controller giving me directions will say, turn right 35 degrees or whatever to a heading of so-and-so, and the turn is that amount there. If you think what you're into, a skateboard or a skater or a dancer, it's that one there. This is the static angle, and this is the dynamic way of thinking about angles. And in the real world, almost always you think about angles dynamically, not statically. So it's the writers of the school textbooks who ought to be apologizing and saying, how come they use that funny way of describing? Well, we know the answer, because it's the influence of pencil and paper. If you're doing things statically on paper, that is the natural way to think about angle. But if you're thinking dynamically, computationally, the other way is the dynamic way. So this shift from this sense of angle to that sense of angle is an example of the way in which the computer allows us to bring into formal mathematical work the dynamic and intuitive idea, in this case of angle, but the same applies to many other concepts. The computer enables us to bring that dynamic, intuitive thing into the mathematical realm. And, well, you could understand that. This is another way that some people use, and no doubt a kid should understand that, but this should be the primary way of doing it. But the point I want to make then, I mean, coming back to my point, to empower that transformation. It's not just that the turtle happens to work like that. The turtle works like that for a reason. And that reason is way bigger than thinking about turtles or squeak or logo. It's about the way in which computational thinking leads to different and more powerful and more natural ways of dealing with big ideas. And that is the thought we have to put outside there. And that kind of example is what can build up into seeing that the point of the computer is not to serve, but to transform. Not to improve, but to render obsolete the ways of thinking. So, I think maybe that's enough. Let's get something. Maybe I'll just tell one little more story, one of my Seward story, which I think last time I told it in public, Kim was there. It was 2 years ago in LA. I just invented this story when I was invited to talk at the AERA, which I hardly ever go to, but had been enticed to go that one time. And talking to these people, the AERA, I told this story. So I like these parables. The parable is about a country where, for reasons that have been lost in the mists of time, people lived mainly on suet. Now, suet is not very nutritive, and it gives you calories, but it's not a good food on the whole. It's not a pleasant food on the whole, but that's what they ate mostly. Well, it's not healthy, but what had happened in this country is that they'd grown up a brilliant, really brilliant tradition of medical researchers who had found out how to sort of make a little additive to the suet to make it a little bit less deadly, or how to cure the diseases that came from eating too much fat. So these suet doctors, it's not that they were ignorant, they really knew it, but they really solved very difficult and hard problems to do this. Now, one day somebody wakes up and says, you know, we've got airplanes and all sorts of technologies these days. We don't have to eat the suet. We can get every kind of food from all over the world. So they go to the doctors and say, design us, and the doctors say no. And the doctors oppose it for all sorts of reasons. And you can think of all sorts of bad reasons, but there's a good reason why. Not ignorance, they just don't know anything about any other diets. They really are very expert about suet. And if you ask suet doctors to design a diet based on green vegetables and all that sort of organic fish, and they don't know about that. Uri Wolensky, who was at that meeting, looked around and he thought everybody in that room was nodding agreement. They were all thinking, he said, the same thing. all these people here are Seward Dodd. Our education research community is a bit like that. We've established a diet, an intellectual diet for our kids. And our education researchers and psychologists and cognitives, they've become very good at understanding how to what to do with this, how to make the best of it, how to undo and understand when it goes wrong as far as is possible. But what they don't know about, what is not part of their business or their tradition or their background, is how to make another diet.
And another point is there's a thriving economy around.
Oh yeah, and it's another point on the thriving economy. Yeah, I mean there are all sorts of bad reasons for the opposition. But there's one sort of, this is what is genuine intellectual reason. They, you know, they try this. I don't care that I'm going to lose all my revenue from my patents and my books. And I really want to do this. They still don't know how to do it. And it just seems to them like an impossible thing. And I think that in our education world, a lot of it is like Kim says, there's a big vested interest. But I think beyond that vested interest, there are sincere people who would love to see something different, but they don't know how to think about it. And in this room, there are ideas and experiences which could help them at least get a toehold on how to think about it. What I'm trying to incite is find ways, I know how, find ways to get those ideas, make this content, get those ideas into those circles and get these people thinking. Okay. That they're so far behind what we're doing with just the idea that every kid, we don't have any examples like this. I live in Maine, and I was part of developing the idea in Maine that give every kid a computer. But in the end, it turned out to give every kid in middle school a computer. And that immediately, it's better than nothing. There's no question that it's a good thing to do. But it's different, because where they really need it is in first grade. And they really need it so that they begin to develop the different ways of thinking from the beginning. And besides, the system needs to change. And what I really believe and hope is that there are countries who classify themselves as developing countries, which means they want to change. And that's not like this country, which classifies itself as a developed country. We're there. And although we complain a lot about our schools and say we've got problems, and basically Americans are self-satisfied and complacent. I think they're coming to be a shock, and I think we are going to exploit that shock. I think we're going to get a better result, and I think you might. Yeah.
Well, the path I've been studying is the Bill Gates Foundation, and how the statistics coming out of their studies has showed the, you know, the dropout rate in high schools, and the statistics that are coming out of the schools as performance-based are tragic. And they're eliminating the arts. And so I think there's a panic, just that people aren't feeling that their children are coming out educated.
Well,
the world.
Yes, I agree with you. There's already a growing sense of disquiet. But I think that people seeing statistics, I mean, education kind of statistics, it doesn't really hit them in the gut. It ought to, and it makes them uncomfortable and squirm, but it's not strong enough to make big action. Yeah.
Could you speak to, you're going to have this massive infusion of technology into Brazil or into these countries. What are you doing to the system? What will you do to the educational system to make the kinds of changes?
Well, of course there are lots of answers to lots of things. But what I really believe deep down in me, I believe anything that we try to do is not going to be what's important, except if it's planting seeds of something that can grow there. And I think that having the context of having everybody, every kid have a lot of time to computers does not automatically produce deep results. I mean, it'll produce, dropout rate will be less. Kids will be more excited about school. They will learn whatever they're learning better, but that's not going to be transformative. What's going to be transformative is when they start doing different things. And when they start, how are they going to start doing different things? Well, I believe it's going to be like every big, you know, technological innovation always comes into use through a small number of early adopters who will stick their necks out and try it, try and do something different, and these will entrain the others. I think what's going to be important in whatever countries adopt this is not what happens across the board in the first year, it's whether 1 or 2 or 5% of schools and teachers really try to do something different, and what exactly what you guys are doing. I think we'll get some programming, some computational ideas, get that in, but in a context now where it can grow much more readily because all these computers are available and where there's a spirit of looking for big change. So that's the way I think about it, and we'd welcome ideas about how to do that. I imagine that when these computers go out, that the first thing that will happen, which has happened everywhere where you get laptops coming in, for the first 3 months or maybe a year, most teachers are going to be, it's going to be just so wonderful having these things, and mostly you're just going to do the same things, but using them in the easy way, like for reading. And these have a quality that's been given, it's been very energetically built into the design system that it's better than these laptops in many ways. One being that it's designed to be a comfortable reading device. The laptops really are not comfortable. You can't lie down, it's uncomfortable lying down, but this one, I suppose you've seen pictures, you can see them on the web easily enough if you look at laptop.org. But the thing folds around and it's got a handle and it's a bit heavy for an e-book, but it's much better than this. So they'll use them for reading and writing and sending messages, basically. But what we'd like to have on it is a few samples of bits of mathematics. Like some of this stuff, I'm dealing with angles and dynamics, and a little bit of how to introduce programming. And these would be seeds planted there. And I think most teachers won't pick them up very quickly, but some will. And then I think the big effort, and this is really going to provoke all of you becoming part of that effort. It's got to be a grassroots effort of producing ideas and things that can contribute to the teachers who are reaching out for more interesting things to do with it, to do that.
Yeah. You started to speak about it, I've read it again. The part of the $100 laptop project that's one of the most interesting to me, gets less attention, there's been so much discussion about hardware and the brilliance of the design. What in that native distribution of software that goes out, whatever goes out when that thing launches, that would be to me what reveals the agenda of the partners in the project. So when you say a little bit of this and that, we're talking specifically about Squeak or some logo, what's going to be on those machines when they go out? Or is that specific to the national partners?
Well, partly it's specific. I mean, partly the national partners are. They haven't been very energetic. The Brazilians a little bit more than the others, but they haven't been very energetic about thinking about. But I think I'm just saying the same thing again. What will go out is on the machine some form of programming
programming language in the family that Squeak and Logo and so on belong to. Exactly what form is really not, but there'll be definitely some form of programmability open, designed to be good for kids. There will be some samples, some pieces of mathematics work that enable a few topics in mathematics, like doing turtle geometry, doing simulations of population dynamics and ecological things. The things that we know, there are a few things that we've had a lot of experience in how to bring these to kids. Doing physics through thinking of the particle instead of a static particle, like Alan's favorite demonstration about the thing falling under gravity. We'll have a few samples of this sort of things you can do in math and in science. There'll be some example of some obvious things like you can use the computer to make do a history research. There's no deep ideas necessary. There are deep ideas to, you don't need deep ideas to get going. So that's what it'll be, but it'll be more samples than a final thing, because we can't make a whole new curriculum. But that the idea is to put out pieces that will incite people to. And I think that the whole idea is sufficiently dramatic. I think it's fairly scary in the developing countries and sufficiently inspirational in the developed countries and sufficiently inspirational in the developing countries that a lot more people will be drawn into wanting to do good things, and that's going to be an evolutionary process, I believe deeply.
Yes. Go back to your comment about this being a grassroots effort. I've got an opportunity where I have the ability to be an agent of change in a single school, and I'll just describe that a little bit. My wife is the assistant principal at this school. It's a Catholic school. I've joined the technology committee, not wanting to buy into CUSUA doctors, but specifically wanting to be an agent of change. And I guess my question for you is, since you've had a lifelong struggle with this, when I run into the inevitable barriers that I'm sure I will, what sort of advice would you give me for handling those?
Well, I think evolution, grassroots, plant seeds. Think about what can you do that will be a seed for development of the system. And that doesn't necessarily mean what's good for the kids in the immediate. So I would, I don't know if this is a formulaic answer, but it is a formula, it's a formulaic answer. I would cast my eye around, look at that system. Where is the entry place? You know, maybe there's a biology teacher there who might resonate to the idea of making programmed models to represent ecological interaction and get programming in via that route. For example, I think to avoid the obvious approach, I think probably the way to change mathematics teaching is not by changing the mathematics teachers, because they've got too much vested interest in doing it. And it's not only their vested interest. See, the mathematics teacher, if I'm a mathematics teacher, my job as far as the bureaucrats is concerned, that I'm going to be judged on, is how well kids do mathematics, which is defined as certain very specific kind of knowledge. And although a different approach might lead me to do that, help kids do that knowledge, learn that knowledge more easily, basically, as long as I'm confined to that being the knowledge they've got to learn, I'm very limited. Biology teacher has a different set of goals, like understand ecology, or understand genetics. Now, if mathematics can help understand genetics, that biology teacher might be more open to taking in mathematics than the mathematics teacher, because because mathematics can actually help the goals that are the official goals for the biology teacher, but new kinds of mathematics are contrary to the official. I only mean that as an example to think with, that to say, we don't look for the direct route, but I think look at this as a system problem and find the places where you can.
Yeah, I've been working on, I started my first Lego League team there this year, and that's kind of my inroad. I've got some of the children of the school board. They're going to be kind of part of my team on this.
There you go. That's
my wife. I'm working on her. I'm going to use this for principal thinking legally.
That's good.
Good
advice to hear.
Any other questions? Comments? Yes, I'm curious about what you said about Jean Piaget, because his studies are still used as the starting point for many theories. As a pedagogist, I'm very curious about if you can state that one of his biggest mistakes or errors, because many of the things he said are still useful, but maybe we have never been enough courageous to say where he went wrong, or where can be made better, or from where we must start to get further.
Yeah, well, first of all, let's put aside what has been most influential in leading people to say, dump Piaget because research has shown he was wrong. Most of what has influenced people that way is totally irrelevant. You know, the fact that you can show that babies know more than he thought that they knew has got nothing to do with how development happens later. But this has been used very loudly as a way of sort of sweeping Piaget out, because he made rash statements about how little babies, he really didn't know very much about. And in a sense, it's quite transparent in his writing that what he knew about very small babies was based on observing his own, whereas with older children, it was based on looking at thousands of children and having a lot of discussion with a lot. So there's all that he makes a lot of wrong statements. Nevertheless, some interesting writing, but let's put that aside. And now on the development later on, the other thing that, I think the big thing that he did wrong was failing to recognize that there could be a big change in the day-to-day practice of life. I'm going to say that for Piaget, it's very important that to look at the roots of intellectual development in what the children do. So, for example, one correspondence leading to conservation of number, and this is everywhere in the life of the child, and one shoe and one sock and one foot, and setting the table, placing knives and forks. It's all over the place. And so there's a root for nucleus for certain kinds of thinking to develop, and these kinds of thinking show themselves in that part of intellectual development that comes about fairly spontaneously, although social, in the society, it's the practices of the society, and that's the part that happens relatively easily, let's say, and you see it have a natural logic of its own. Now, where I think I differ most from Piaget, and in fact didn't try to discuss this with him, but it was only at the end of his life, and he was very interested, but it was too late in his life for him to really think through how to rethink so many things. But I think that the computer means that there are new kinds of concrete activities like setting the table or putting our shoes and socks on. So there are things that become concrete that were very formal and abstract before. So what's happened is a change in this concrete basis from which the formal systems grow. So I think this doesn't mean that his distinction between concrete and formal is has to be thrown away. It's just conceptually it's still the same and it's still there, but its content is different, because what is concrete is what's concrete in terms of the life of the kid. And now there are different things that are concrete in terms of the life of the kid. And I think that that's also something like shifting the sense of angle there. Thank you, but I mean, I think next time I get a chance to talk about this or in writing I'm doing on this, I will bear in mind that question and use this other example, because you know, I think that if you look back at the history of discussion of Piaget's ideas, are they really dependent? Is this about something innate? Or essentially some basic law of development? Or does it depend on the culture and the life of people around? And kind of experiments that were done were like, you go into an African village and you see whether they develop in conservation, like the kids in Geneva or New York. And yes, they do, and when you collect a lot of evidence like that, you start saying, well, it's not dependent on the particular society or culture. It's something essential, innate, or biological, or theoretical laws of development, maybe more like laws of a science that belong to a science of development. But as I see it now, looking back, I think in some important ways, the little African village, this is before $100 laptops get, the little African village is more like New York as it was before the computers came than either of them is like the computer age. In other words, we see the commonalities that we see are all the product of the fact that we lived in an age where objects were static. And when objects become dynamic, this is different. And that's the difference that makes the difference. So it makes a difference of what things are to be counted as, or what things are formal, what things are common, what are the forms of the concrete. And you might, I wrote an early paper, I really mean to take this up again, I wrote a paper with Sherry Turkle called it's called Epistemological Pluralism, re-evaluating the concrete, or re-something? I can't even remember the name of my own paper. But the point was to rethink what we mean by concrete. Because I think that was an extremely valuable notion, but with the richer experience we have, it's in its specific forms, it's not the same as it was. So on that, so that's the way I think of that. Basic Piagetian ideas are really important, but you can take them literally transposed from the 1920s and 30s, which is when he really developed his ideas, to the 21st century. The idea of assimilation and accommodation, looking at these two, it's just fundamental. And Piaget really was the first person to find, and it runs through his work. And throwing out, this is what's happening with Piaget is throwing a baby with the bathtub in one of the most sad ways, self-destructive ways that I've seen. But it's not just, you've got to consider, why is it? We're putting a different context. Why are these things that I'm saying not being just obvious to all the people in education theory and cognitive science? And I think a couple of reasons. One is that Piaget is a radical and most of these people are conservatives in relation to education. That's insofar as they come into education, they want to improve it, they don't want to change it. They don't want to think about the content. And just to take a little personal thing, how I became involved with Piaget maybe speaks, tells the whole story. Piaget got money from American foundations to revisit his studies of different aspects of the development of intelligence. First one, and he was about to spend a year re-examining his ideas about the development of number, as do normal. So he wanted, he had funds to hire and assist somebody to work with him. Now, I really think that almost anybody in the standard psychological educational world would have said, let's find a psychologist who's interested in that. Piaget didn't want to find a psychologist, he wanted to find a mathematician who was willing to spend a year immersed in thinking about children. Because he thought, if you want to think about number, you need a mathematician, you don't need a psychologist. And I think that's just a principle that's so deep and runs right through the difference between Piaget and his critics. So by accident, his scout found, one of his scouts found me, and I went there. And in fact, we hit it off, and the year turned into 4 years in the end. And that's why I'm here talking to you about these things. But so I can't say anything. I'm going to be eternally grateful to him. In any case, I mean, he got me here, whatever. But I think that kind of way of looking, this is epistemology. And you understand the development of number, it's epistemology, it's understanding the concept, the number, and not, it's not about making cognitive models of the brain or...
Thank you, that was a really great story.
Yeah, this might come from totally left field, but you're one of the thinkers I've actually been paying that come up and have been paying attention to in the last couple of years. Another one is people like James Howard Kunstler, and I'm starting to see kind of a, which, you know, you're familiar with his a lot, some people's more or less alarmist theory, and some people are very far along the paranoid fringe, and some people are a little bit more mainstream about, like, what do we do when our resources do run out or become unusable just because they're hard to get. The long emergency theory that oil is going to run out. We're going to, regardless of what we have to change, or where you're coming from, or what we'd like to change, what we have to change. I see something in the laptop project as being some way to switch over to kind of a less destructive global mentality, but maybe
well, I mean, that's obviously going to be a big other challenge, but
yeah.
I really think that what you just said is absolutely right. I think that it's another angle on the sense of urgency and panic and opportunity that the whole global, I emphasize the global economy, but the global environment and the idea of sustainability and the idea that we can't take for granted the sort of structure of the world, and that globalization means really things are, you know, we could destroy the world or we can make new opportunities. Or, all these, I think, contribute to creating a situation where it's at least possible that the idea of change in learning and education could acquire enough urgency for people to be prepared to make that big jump. Because I think it's got to, that's how the school, it's such a huge thing. It's not only huge physically, it's huge in our minds. I once did this calculation, I've forgotten the answer, but it's surprising to do the calculation. At what age of your life could you say that you spent more years out of school than in school? You're amazingly far along before. Yeah, by the time you've been through K through 12 and college and maybe some post-grad, you're talking 20 years and add 20 years on to 20 something, and you're up there in the 40s to 50 before you can say I spent more time out of school, that it's so it must be a big stamp on our. So it's a big thing to overthrow that. And it's going to need a big force, and I think that that sort of consideration adds to it. It adds to the, not certainty, but at least makes one feel that we're moving into a period where there's, that we can get more leverage to bring about this big change. So let's try. In any case, if you don't try, it won't happen.